Did you know using your browser in incognito mode doesn't actually protect your privacy? Take back your privacy with IPVanish VPN. Just one tap and all your data, passwords, communications, browsing history, and more will be instantly protected. IPVanish makes you virtually invisible online. Use IPVanish on all your devices, anytime you go online at home, and especially on public Wi-Fi. Get IPVanish now for 70% off a yearly plan with this exclusive offer at ipvanish.com/audio.
I just don't buy live rabbits to feed my dogs, so...
Yeah.
Welcome to Wreckatopia, a happy home for recommended movies, TV shows, music, video games, foodstuffs, and more from two people you can definitely trust. Trustability varies by region, no guarantees implied. And now, here are your hosts, Chris Atkinson and Aaron Dicer.
You're a tough man to get a hold of, Jeffrey.
What do you want?
It's not what I want. It's what you want. How bad you want it, because it is going to cost you. Can't show it to you right now. But it's about 5'5", 115 pounds, three or four of that just pure tit. Nice curly brown hair upstairs and down. Interested?
Hello, everybody. It is episode 130 of Wreckatopia. I'm Chris Atkinson, joined by Aaron Dicer.
Heidely ho, Russell Renos.
Yes, and thank you, chat, for coming out and watching us talk about movies on a Tuesday. Today's big recommend is Breakdown from 1997. And I'm going to start us off with some small recommend.
It's no big deal.
Itty-bitty living space.
It's so small and light.
It's small, it's tiny, it's petite, it's wee.
We'll start off with an Orson Welles movie from 1947 called The Lady from Shanghai. I had never seen this before. There's a lot of Orson Welles that I've just kind of missed over the years. Well, you know, the guy made a movie that just overshadowed all movies, basically, and everything that he's come out with after that are kind of like sort of afterthoughts, it feels like. Even stuff like Touch of Evil, which is a really amazing movie and everything. But The Lady from Shanghai features Orson Welles in a starring role with Rita Hayworth, who was his wife at the time. He meets her on a horse. He meets her while she's driving by on a horse carriage, and he instantly falls head over heels because she's Rita Hayworth. Something happens where she's about to get robbed, and he goes in and beats up all the guys that are about to rob her. And she says, "Well, would you like to have a job on me and my husband's like boat, our yacht, or whatever?" He's like, "Really would like you to be on there. Really need you to be on there." Puts on the full court press. He's like, "I don't know. You're married, and I wanted to have sex with you, so I don't know if I want to." I don't know if I want to do this now. And so through enough happenstance, of course, he ends up on the yacht. And then he suddenly runs into a whole bunch of characters who are just always asking or are always sort of acting in a weird manner. He meets Rita Hayworth's husband, who's a lawyer, a very wealthy lawyer, and he's a business partner with this other guy who's kind of off himself. And this guy, the business partner, is starting to talk about weird stuff about, like, if I died, there would be this big insurance policy that would go their way and all this other stuff. And suddenly, he's asking Orson Welles if he would kill him. Now, I'm not going to go beyond that because there's a lot of stuff in the plot that you have to weed out here. It is a fascinating movie. It's got to be the first Hall of Mirrors type scene in a movie history. I think it's been emulated since. Very awesome one, in 1947, how they did that and everything. But this is a fascinating movie. It's well photographed, of course. It's an amazing, amazing looking movie. It can be kind of confusing at times, but I really, really enjoyed this. This was a really good movie.
It's a nice little noir thriller, you know, from the 40s kind of watch. And that's before you get to the amazing stuff, like you mentioned, the Hall of Mirrors scene, you know, years before Skyscraper would perfect the art of using, reflections. I watched it last night. I knew you were going to talk about it today, and I wanted to check it out. If for no other reason, to see Orson Welles try to pull off an Irish brogue.
And he does not do that very well, by the way.
He does not. Like, why did he have to be Irish? Just, you know, just change the character. There's nothing about the character that needed him to do that. You get the feeling Orson was like, oh, I'm going to nail this. I'm going to win an Academy Award for this. I don't even know.
Oh, yeah.
I'd recommend it as well. It's on Criterion Channel if you want to check it out.
Yep.
My first small recommend today is a recent movie called The Instigators. This is getting mixed reviews, I believe, if I'm reading correctly into the zeitgeist. But this is an Apple TV Plus movie that was originally supposed to be in theaters for a while, but then they changed their mind and just kind of did the put it in a couple theaters and then just drop it on Apple TV Plus thing. It's Matt Damon and Casey Affleck, and it's about as close as you're going to get to a non-Oceans movie. It's very heisty. There's a lot of that fun wit and repartee here. I will say, surprisingly enough, Matt Damon's probably the worst part of the movie. I don't think he's very good here, but Casey Affleck is great. I love the character he's playing. And Michael Stuhlbarg shows up in this movie in a way I've never seen, like a performance I would not expect from him. And I thought he was really good as well. Plus Hong Chau's here. She's really funny.
Oh, she's always great.
And her chemistry, especially with Casey Affleck, is just through the roof. Paul Walter Hauser shows up. He's got a great role to play here. This is just a fun watch. It's just a really fun heist watch, and I don't want to give the impression that Damon's bad. He's not. I don't know that Matt Damon really could be bad. He's just got that charisma, but he's not the best part of this movie. I think it's probably Hong Chau and Casey Affleck. But it's a lot of fun. If you like heist movies and you like, you know, good witty dialogue, check it out.
I always see this, being advertised anytime I run around Apple TV. So I may have to give this a look. I love the fact that there's a market for movies like this, even if it's not perfect or whatever. It's, you know, it's, hey, this was just, hey, we're kind of messing around doing a fun movie. And, you know, there's a lot of value to those.
Yep.
Things, so last week when I was trying to come up with a double feature for Gattaca, I came up with Talented Mr. Ripley, and then I went to a movie night that some friends and I always have, like once a month. And one of the movies that we watched was Purple Noon from 1960, which just so happens to be an adaptation of Mr. Ripley from the Patricia Highsmith novel. This, if you've seen the Talented Mr. Ripley, Purple Noon follows quite a bit of that. Now, I've never read the novel, so I don't know which adaptation is closest. But once you start watching Purple Noon, you'll start seeing some parallels. And I actually had let it slip my head. I did not read anything into this movie when the friend introduced it. But I saw Patricia Highsmith's name. I did not see what it was adapted from in the credits. And they get on a boat, and there's a point where I was like, man, this is everything about this feels like the Talented Mr. Ripley, everything. And I turned to one of my friends. I was like, they said Patricia Highsmith, right? And they're like, yeah, it's adaptation of Mr. Ripley. I was like, oh, that explains it. So like everything about this movie has that kind of thing in it. Now, what is cut out of this from cut out what is not here, which is in the 1999 version, the Matt Damon character is gay in the 1999 version. This guy, he's a little bit more ambiguous on that, although
very Eurosexual, bisexual energy kind of thing.
And so while he definitely has an infatuation with his friend in this, he also has an infatuation with Marge, the Gwyneth Paltrow character from Talented Mr. Ripley. And so the scheme in this is completely different from that. And but this movie, if you've seen Talented Mr. Ripley, it works completely on its own. It's complete. It's a great compliment to Talented. I think I ended up liking Talented Mr. Ripley more than this one, but this one is right up there. It's right there. And I'm sure that there's some people out there who are like, Purple Noon is right up there with Talented Mr. Ripley. How about the other way around, man? But I really enjoyed this. We watched this mainly because Alain Delon, I took 4 years of French, I swear to God. Alain Delon recently died, and we had a double feature of his. The other one we saw was The Red Circle, but I have recommended that on both Sincast and this one. So I had to not do that this time. But yes, Purple Noon is great. It's a great performance from Alain Delon as well. And if you want to talk about like just super sexy too, like just an absolutely sexy performance from him as well. So really, really good stuff.
Yeah, it was funny. After I watched it, I went on Letterboxd to write my review, and then I'll read other reviews. And I'm not kidding. Every single review was just thirsting for Alain Delon. Just because he just exudes like that sensuality, and he's a gorgeous, gorgeous man. But Purple Noon was interesting because, especially just coming off the TV show Ripley. Did you ever get around to watching the Ripley TV show?
I never saw the TV show. No.
So Ripley the TV show is a lot similar to Purple Noon than it is Talented Mr. Ripley. In other words, the plot points from the book, I think, that are included in Purple Noon are also included in the Ripley TV show, you know, that kind of extends that story out. The only thing I didn't like about this movie was the ending. I thought the ending felt a little bit cheap to me, especially considering that I think that's different than the book and different than the book's intent. And what it's trying to say and what it's trying to do, but it's a really great watch for the performances, the actors, and just if you like this story, you know, just another version.
I didn't look into this afterwards, but I turned to my friends after this movie ended and I said, "Did the foreign language films that came over to America, did they have to follow the Hays Code?" when they needed to be seen. And one friend was adamant, no, they didn't have to. I was like, well, that doesn't make sense, because how would you get a movie made over there and then come over here without following the same rules? It's one thing I've never looked into. They either followed it, or they didn't have to follow it over in their country and they could play it, but they wouldn't be able to get an American distribution. Or they just kind of said, well, look, we need American distribution, so we will just go ahead and follow the Hays Code, even though we're not under that over here. So that's something I've never looked into. I want to research it more, but that's the reason why I think that ending is the way it is in that movie. So
I think you might be right.
So there you go.
My second small recommend, went back in time just a little bit and finally got around to seeing The Lives of Others. This is a German film, I believe, at least all in German, with German performers. And the idea of this is that the Stasi, the secret service of the German police, are, you know, encouraging people to report on each other. They're spying on their citizens. They're, you know, trying to find out who's with them, who's against them, that kind of thing. And it kind of follows both a Stasi member who's, you know, kind of one of their best interrogators and his moral crisis, as well as a writer who is, you know, a writer of plays who is maybe trying to do something they're going to try to find out, right? So that's like the whole thing that's going on here. But there's some great performances. The tension is amazing. The story turns in this are really, really good. And I was involved from beginning to end. So I wanted to recommend it because I think it's a really, really good film.
Yep. We big recommended this back in the day. And I can wholeheartedly second this. This is a great, great movie. If you are late to the party, listening to us, The Lives of Others is one of the greatest movies that have come out in the last 25 years, I think. And it's got an ending that will sock you in the gut too, or at least make you cry or something. So
It's really, really good.
I see there's a lot of discussion about the Hays Code, and a lot of you in the chat are explaining it beautifully, so I don't think I'm going to have to go too far in that. But the Hays Code was a morals code that the movies had to follow. They didn't want to have sex and nudity and bad language and all that. And then there were other things where if you were a bad guy, you could not get away with the crime at the end of the movie. So you watched movies where somebody's doing a crime, and you knew as an audience member back then, something's going to happen. They're either going to die, they're going to go to jail, you know, that type of thing. So
just like in life, nobody gets away with crime. Just like
nobody ever gets away with anything. So yeah, the Hays Code then was sort of ignored in the 60s a little bit, not totally. And then it got ignored enough that they came up with the rating system that we have today. All right, on to our big recommend, which is Breakdown from 1997.
I'm fine. It's just that you're so big.
It's so huge.
It's a good rule, but this is bigger than rules.
It's bigger on the inside.
Is it?
I noticed.
And yes, as someone in the chat mentioned, we're going to get a breakdown of Breakdown.
Woo-hoo.
I agree. There was a time when back at the movie theater, we would at the Hollywood 27, we'd have to write in a journal and tell people what we did during the day. And a lot of times we would break down movies. And so, like, this did not happen for Breakdown, but when the movie Broke Down Palace came out, it was fun to write Broke Down Palace.
Mm-hmm.
So there you go. On to our actual breakdown here. Jeff Taylor, played by Kurt Russell, and his wife Amy, played by Kathleen Quinlan, are driving from Massachusetts to California to take new jobs. They are in the middle of some western state when a truck pulls out in front of them, seemingly from nowhere, and there is a near accident. Upon visiting a gas station, they see the driver of that truck, Earl, played by MC Gainey, who makes a lot of aggressive, positive comments about the Taylor's Jeep Cherokee before revealing that he was in fact the man who pulled out in front of Jeff, only he doesn't see it that way. The Taylors tear out of there as soon as they can, and Amy shows him the snacks they got, including a plot-relevant pack of donuts with a contest where you could win $90,000 or 90,000 donuts. It's not long after this, the car begins to die, and the movie's title comes true. Earl and his truck drive by and then turn around, seemingly threatening the Taylors, until a trucker by the name of Red Barr, played by J.T. Walsh, stops for them and offers help. Red says he can take them to a diner where they can make a phone call for a tow. But Red mentioned something about how new cars like theirs can simply overheat if pushed, which after you watch this movie, I do not understand why he does this. So Jeff decides to stay with the car while Amy takes the ride with Red. Jeff decides to look under the car and find some loose wiring, and I'm like, how did that happen? How'd they do that? How did they make it where the car would run and then the wires would come loose? Lo and behold, that was the problem. So he gets back in the car and drives to the diner, but Amy isn't there. The surly manager hasn't seen her and seems irritated he even asks. Jeff then decides to drive to the next town, but he runs into Red's truck first. Red is not interested in pulling over, and when he finally gets him to stop, Red claims he's never seen Jeff before and knows nothing about his wife. A sheriff stops by and checks everything out, but there isn't any evidence to keep Red any longer. Amy isn't in the truck, and there are no signs of a struggle. Is it possible Jeff is having a mental? Title of the movie? The sheriff tells him to visit his deputy and file a missing persons case. After he does that, Jeff goes back to the diner to see if Amy's shown up. Now the surly manager of the place is extra surly, especially when Jeff demands to see all the order tickets to see if Amy's name appears on any of them. After giving up, a local yokel by the name of Billy, played by Jack Noseworthy, claims to have seen her at the diner, and she left with some man headed somewhere on Route 7. Jeff drives down Route 7 and finds a gate blocking his path, and is quickly greeted by Earl again, this time holding a rifle. Jeff decides to crash the gate, and a chase ensues, but he is eventually blocked by bulldozers and such, causing Jeff to do a mad, 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 mad world into the river, which he floats down until the Jeep finally stops. Earl starts shooting, but Jeff swims out of danger, seeing the all-important donut wrapper just before he gets out of the water. Earl gets our rarely seen third accomplice, Al, to tow the Jeep out of the water while Jeff watches from some trees. But then local yokel Billy, who I guess was on search for Jeff in the trees duty, finds him and knocks him out. Billy was faking being a yokel all along. He's actually like terrifying, actually. He tells Jeff that Amy told him that there is a certain dollar amount in their account. Earl is about to shoot him because he believes Amy lied to them about being a donut king. But luckily, Jeff remembers the amount on the wrapper and tells them about the $90,000 that definitely doesn't exist. They take him to Red. Red now wants Jeff to go down to a local bank and withdraw the $90,000 to get his wife back, with assurances they are watching him. Jeff goes to the bank and withdraws $5,000 because that's all he has. He has a notion to tell the banker about this situation, but a suspicious guy comes asking the banker about a car loan and sits way too close to the desk for Jeff to tell a wild story without being heard. He takes his $5,000 and leaves the bank, then gets a call on a payphone. He is told to walk down the main road where Earl will eventually catch up to him and collect the money. Earl duct tapes Jeff in the truck and drives off. Jeff reaches for a letter opener he was able to take from the banker and store in his sock while Earl takes a call. Finally, Earl takes a look at the money that Jeff is trying to pass off as $90,000 while Jeff cuts the tape that's binding him. Earl discovers the truth about the money right as Jeff stabs him in the neck. After a struggle, the truck gets stopped and Jeff tapes Earl up like a poorly wrapped Christmas present. Jeff has set up a system where if he applies the brakes on the truck, it will choke Earl, so he gets information that way. But the sheriff from earlier sees the craziness going on and pulls the truck over. Jeff gets out of the car, and while he tries to explain, Earl cuts himself free and shoots the sheriff. When Earl has Jeff cornered again, the injured sheriff shoots Earl dead. Jeff takes the truck and finds a truck stop where he secretly finds Red. Red takes a call at a payphone where Jeff finds out that his underlings still have his wife, and they're going to meet Earl at his house to lay low since they know a cop was killed and or a cop was shot, and Earl may have been involved. When Red takes off, Jeff runs to catch a rung underneath the rig, holding on for dear life. He is eventually able to climb into that spot between the truck and the container hooked up on the back and rides all the way to Earl's house, to Red's house. Why did that again? It suddenly went Earl on everything. Red's got a wife and a son named Deke. Eventually, Red is greeted by Billy and Al. Jeff climbs on top of a barn to spy on them. Their main mission is to get rid of evidence. And it looks like Amy made the trip too. They put her in a storage place on another truck, and she appears dead at first because she doesn't move. But when they try to move her, she starts to struggle, proving she's alive, and they store her down in a cellar in a freezer. When they leave, Jeff tries to break into the cellar, but to no avail. He does find a gun in one of the trucks and then goes into the house to threaten the adults in the kitchen while Deke plays Doom. Jeff demands they give him the key to the cellar, but the yelling draws Deke into the kitchen, brandishing a rifle. Unfortunately for Red, Deke is no killer. Jeff takes the rifle away, but in the chaos, Billy escapes. Eventually, Jeff gets Red's wife to open the cellar and then the freezer with Amy inside. Jeff then makes Red, his crew, and his family go down into the cellar, which he then barricades and locks. They find a truck next to a trailer, so they go inside it to find the keys, which they eventually do. In the meantime, Billy finds a gun and rescues Red and the others. Red gets in his rig and smashes into the trailer, barely missing Amy and Jeff. They get in the truck and start it up before Red smashes into them. They get on the highway, but Billy and Al catch up to them in other cars, flanking on both sides. Eventually, Jeff gets the smart idea to put on the brakes while Billy and Al point guns, which saves them for a second, but now taking up the rear is Red and his rig. Eventually, Jeff is able to clip Billy, whose car flips over and erupts into flames, as they do. When Red applies his brakes too hard, the container on the back of his truck goes sideways, and that does end Al, who crashes into it. The chase now goes onto a bridge, where Red gets the advantage and pushes Jeff and Amy through the barricades and nearly off the edge. Jeff gets out of the truck and jumps into Red's to fight him, causing Red's truck to teeter off the edge and saving Amy for the moment. Jeff now finds himself hanging for dear life outside while Red is inside trying to make his way up. Jeff climbs and catches up to Red, who tries to knock Jeff off by hitting him with chains and almost succeeds until Jeff grabs one end of the chains while the other end gets wrapped around Red. Jeff yanks the chains and Red falls to what we think is his death. Jeff then jumps into the truck and he has to get Amy out before she falls off the bridge. But guess what? Red is still alive down there. He probably can't do much in his condition after smashing into rocks down below. But Amy pulls the gear lever of the truck they were driving down, which sends Red's truck over the bridge and into his face, straight murdering that guy. And the movie ends that way.
Sure does.
It ends that way. Aaron, what did you think of this movie?
This movie's a blast. This to me, my first thought upon finishing it was this is the perfect encapsulation of a 90s action thriller, Innocent Man style, right? So this is kind of the updated version of what Hitchcock loved to do, which was take somebody, an innocent man, put them in a crazy situation where all of a sudden they're wanted, they're in trouble, they're in danger, and see how they get out of it. And that is what's going on here. It's very similar. I didn't choose this for my double feature, so I'll mention it now. But, you know, it's the Taken thing, right? It's one of the reasons that Taken works so well is this idea of just like, you know, somebody who is in that situation. The difference between Taken and this is Kurt Russell doesn't necessarily have a particular set of skills, right? Like, you know, that's fun. And so you're seeing him improvise and, you know, escape and do things and find his way out of things. And the movie just never lets up. So it's a really fun, innocent man, 90s kind of thriller. I think Hitchcock would have loved this kind of movie, you know, this idea. Kurt Russell is so good in this role too. I just think he's perfect for this kind of thing. My son watched this movie with me and he was getting pumped up, like just like yelling at the screen at times, kind of fun. And he said afterwards, he said something along the lines of, I really get into that hyper masculine dad energy. And it's like, you're right. There's something about just kind of like, you know, dad on a mission kind of thing that gets the blood pumping. And Kurt Russell fits it so perfectly that I found myself really, really involved in the plot. Then you get to the baddies. It's like a perfect lineup, right? Like JT Walsh is perfect for that role. MC Gainey is a perfect playoff of him. They're very different kind of baddies, but you can see how they work together in their roles. And their plan is interesting, right? The idea that MC Gainey would play the obvious, like, gruff, you know, antagonistic guy. And then, you know, JT Walsh comes along as the level-headed, hey, I'm going to help you out guy. And that's really, you know, how you kidnap someone is you don't take them by force. You let them walk into it. There's a lot of conversation in the movie about, you know, this would have never happened if you'd got both of them at the same time, you know, kind of thing. And it did kind of make me wonder what the plan is. Once you get two people in a semi truck, how you subdue both of them 2-on-1? Like, it got me thinking, like, what is the actual 2-on-1 plan there? How do they, you know, do that? I'm sure they.
I guess he just takes them not to the diner, or their other guys are waiting at the diner or whatever, at that point. But then, you know, the other weird thing about the plot is they don't really. They are interested in them because they have that Jeep Cherokee and it's an amazing vehicle for 1997, I'm assuming. They take interest because they must have a lot of money because of that Jeep. And then they're going to, I mean, really, honestly, they don't have any. So what, you know, they didn't have that donut thing in line. What are they going to say? Anyway.
Yeah. And you get the sense that they're just killing people if they don't have the money. Like, you know, how many people have these guys just murdered, you know, for a possible five-figure win? Like,
that's possibly what all those license plates that are in the barn suggest right there. So, yeah.
Yeah. These are serial murderers. Like, you know, so it's interesting to think about how evil these baddies are, you know, and kind of process that. plenty of great set pieces, nice practical effect action set pieces with people hanging on under trucks and driving vehicles into water. And, you know, you mentioned the Mack truck pancaking J.T. Walsh at the end. You know, that was not J.T. Walsh wasn't under there. I can promise you that.
Right,
but, but that wasn't a CG semi hitting that riverbed. Like, they dropped a semi truck on that rock, you know, like it's really interesting to see the lengths that they go for those kind of fun action set pieces. The chases are all good. The, you know, on the road chases are interesting and fun. And I don't feel like any of the action set pieces overstay their welcome. They don't go on too long. It just feels like the movie has a really good sense of pace and of tone and kind of knows exactly what it is. Through modern eyes, there's a couple things that I saw that I wouldn't have seen in the 90s when I was watching this. It's very interesting how movies then, we talk about movies now as if they're eat the rich, right? You think of like Knives Out, that kind of like don't trust the rich, eat the rich, you know, the poor, you know, getting their you know, the riches comeuppance. Back then it was root for the rich, you know, it was like, you know, and I know they're not like filthy rich, like, you know, but they are, you know, middle class, upper middle class, well-to-do or whatever. And, you know, it's those grungy townspeople that are the, you know, the evil ones or whatever. So it's kind of interesting to see that shift in culture, you know, from trusting the rich to trusting the poor kind of idea. And then the other thing is the Kathleen Quinlan character is nothing, you know, like it's, you know, they try to give her the moment. They do give her the big moment at the end, but I mean, we don't get enough of a sense other than that they kidnapped her as to that character at all. So, you know, you talk of ideas of like, you know, fridging a character, those kind of things. She kind of is that in this movie. She is the motivation for him to do miraculous things. And then they kind of just let her, you know, pull the brake at the end and become a murderer. They let her be the murderer. That's, you know, that's very kind of them.
Well, and that's the other thing, too, is because the movie is trying to put this doubt in your mind whether she's alive or not, they don't ever cut back to her for any scenes, you know, where she's yelling at them or reasoning with them or anything like that. So that effectively cuts her completely out of the movie once she takes that ride and everything. So.
Which is kind of unfortunate because I actually, one of the things I loved at the beginning was their chemistry. I actually thought, you know, that like this is a couple. I really enjoyed the way they bounced off each other. And so, you know, it was sad that we didn't get more of that. But that's not what this movie was setting out to do. It was all about the Kurt Russell character moving mountains to save her, and you know, and that's a ton of fun. I had a blast.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, at the top, I don't want to call anybody out or anything like that, but at the top of the chat there was a comment that said, well, I liked this, but it was nothing special. And I don't know, I guess I agree that it's nothing like overarchingly special. However, the fact is it's so hard to make these types of movies well. That's the reason why I sort of picked this one, because these movies are a dime a dozen. You can find a bunch with this kind of plot and the movie just doesn't arrest you the same way that this one does. And a lot of it has to do with staging of the action scenes, the acting performances in this thing. It's elevated from having a Kurt Russell instead of like, you know, who would be just below Kurt Russell? Would it be like Statham or somebody like that? Statham makes some good movies though. Mm-hmm. So I don't really want to call him out either, but you know, you get the straight to video type of movies where it's
Dolph
like,
Lundgren.
All right, Dolph Lundgren. Yeah, exactly. So you get these type of movies that the acting is like, okay, it's serviceable. The story. Okay. Whatever the stunts and whatever, those aren't very good. They cut away from like the mistakes or the stuff they don't want you to see. This one doesn't shy away from what it's doing here. It shows you the stunts. It may not be the person who's acting the role, but the person doing the stunts is doing the stunts. There's nothing digital about it or anything like that. So when a movie like this is done well, it's really hard to find these. So that's what I want to say about that. I mean, everything everything in this is like, I, except for maybe like a couple, and I've brought up the, you know, the, how they were able to set up the car just such a way where it would move, but then the wires would come loose at a certain point. Maybe they had it dangling there or something. And like, well, after a mile, these wires will disconnect. And then, you know, the donut thing. And like, there's a couple of other little moments in here where they kind of have to throw something in there that's a little unbelievable so that they can continue with the story. But almost everything in this is kind of like, I can kind of see somebody doing this. I mean, they're probably dead. Let's face it. That most of the time, the Kurt Russell, somebody does the things that Kurt Russell does in the movie, probably dead by the end of it. But here's the 1% where someone, you can kind of see somebody possibly getting through this situation where just enough things fall their way that, you know, that it works. And all the scenes in here are tense. That whole thing with the trucks on the bridge has got just, it constantly builds on each other. Like, you know, the same year, 1997, Lost World came out, and it has that terrific trailer over the mountain scene. Maybe probably the one of the best scenes in a movie that's not super great. But, you know, they're in that trailer where, like, all this stuff keeps happening where they're having to hang on and, like, the glass starts breaking and all that. Well, that's what Breakdown does, too, to a certain degree here. And they just keep adding things like, okay, now the truck is in this position, and now these two people are having to climb up, and there's like all sorts of little props that they throw in that just make things, okay, now I was thinking it was going to go this way, now it's going to go the other way. That's what I love about this movie. It just keeps on building on top of each other. So building action scenes and tense scenes with all this sort of extra stuff in it. You think the kid Deke is playing Doom? He won't bother coming into the kitchen when he's wrapped up in Doom, but sure enough, he comes in there with a rifle and is ready to do some damage.
And then his dad's like, shoot him, kid.
Yeah. And the mom even is like, do it, you know? So like, cause she's not quite sure her husband is bastard yet, but she's soon about to find out. So
yeah.
While this movie is like not an elevated above and beyond special movie, these movies are very hard to make, and that's what I appreciate about it, and that's why I recommended it.
And there's extra care. You can feel the extra care taken to build the atmosphere in this movie too. It doesn't rely on just its plot. It structures its story in a way that allows you to start to feel that tension. One of the best scenes in the movie that doesn't get a lot of praise is the first scene in the diner. You know, going into that diner and the feeling of everyone in here, you know, might not be who they seem. And there are close-ups on almost everybody in that diner at one point, as either the first or second time that he's in there. And it's all handled really, really well. And I was going to look up the Jack McGee. Jack McGee is the bartender, you know,
yeah,
guy
there.
Yeah, I love
him.
Whatever.
He's so great.
And he's perfect for that. Like, you know, and so I just think that you can feel those extra levels of care in a movie that's done well, as opposed to one that's just, you know, coloring by numbers.
It's playing off of a thing that we've been seeing in movies where it's like, something happens and everybody's in on it. The whole town is in on it or whatever. And so everything about that diner is like, oh, well, maybe they're the ones who are in on it or whatever. Maybe they've, and especially when he talks to Billy later and Billy's like, your wife went into the diner and all that. And then Kurt Russell's ready to be like, that bartender's behind it because he's such a dick. And, you know, and it's a good kind of misdirection because it doesn't go heavily into it. It just kind of lets your mind wander, but it doesn't sit there and just like put so much like evidence and suspicion on those people. It just makes you think maybe they're a part of it. Cause what else could be going on around here basically?
Well, and it's a nice little, you know, swipe of the carpet from under your feet too with the law enforcement part of it too, where, and by the way, we haven't mentioned Rex Lynn's name, who is, you know, great as that first cop that shows up. And yeah. You start to think, are the police in on it? And then one of the characters that you think maybe you're supposed to trust says, you don't get it. Everybody's in on it. The police are in on it.
Mm-hmm.
And the movie doesn't make a big to-do about the reveal that the Rex Lynn character, the police, aren't in on it. It just has him, take a bullet and then, you know, shoot the guy or whatever. And I don't know. It just all feels really well handled to me. It's just a really good movie.
And just think, if they had done that, if they had just decided to go with all these, red herrings and everything, the movie becomes 2 hours at that point. Because
right.
Kurt Russell's going to be following every lead he can, and then he's going to run into dead ends, and it's just going to be a waste of our time. This is supposed to be a tight, car chase type of movie and thriller. So, anyway, I appreciate all of that. And I know that, for some of you guys, it's not special, but I would politely disagree with you.
I mean, how much do we want more movies like this today, though? And I don't mean this exact plot. I just mean like movies you can just throw on. Like I was just talking about The Instigators. It kind of feels like just a well-done movie you can throw on and have fun, And, increasingly it's all about the big special effects and the big properties and franchises. And, man, a breakdown would be great to see pop up every once in a while.
And think about this, too. This movie came out on the first weekend of May, which you would never do with a movie like this nowadays. I mean, I think it was Twister that really started that May first big blockbuster of the, and that was a year before. So they hadn't quite gotten into that being a thing every week, but like they were trying to finally movies started trying to beat that Memorial Day thing. But yeah, you would never, ever, ever come out with a breakdown on May 2nd of 2024. You would be reserving that for it would end up being a September or April release or something. So all right, on to our super secret double feature.
So just like you, I like to save money, and that's why when Mint Mobile came over to our little corner of the internet, I started to pay attention. And let me tell you, something interesting happened. I realized that I think I have an unhealthy relationship with my existing provider. I had to do this thing where it's like, should I try something new? No. I've been with this provider for so long. And then I got to looking at my bill and I thought, do I really want to keep spending this much money when it appears that Mint Mobile can do the exact same for $15 a month? And that's when I started to click around and find out. To get started, I did just what you can do. Go to mintmobile.com/recotopia. And then right there is where I saw the 3 month plans that were like $15 a month. And that includes the unlimited plan. All of the plans come with high speed data and unlimited talk and text. And they deliver all that on the nation's largest 5G network, which is great. Even better, you can use your own phone number. And I'm kind of, connected emotionally to my phone number. Another thing I probably should dig into in therapy. So to get this new customer offer and your new 3 month premium wireless plan for just $15 a month, go to mintmobile.com/recotopia. That's mintmobile.com/recotopia. You can cut your wireless bill to $15 a month at mintmobile.com/recotopia. There is a $45 upfront payment required that's equivalent to $15 a month. New customers on first 3 month plan only. Speeds slower above 40 gigabytes on unlimited plan, and additional taxes, fees, and restrictions apply. See Mint Mobile for details.
Did you know using your browser in incognito mode doesn't actually protect your privacy? Take back your privacy with IPVanish VPN. Just one tap and all your data, passwords, communications, browsing history, and more will be instantly protected. IPVanish makes you virtually invisible online. Use IPVanish on all your devices, anytime you go online at home, and especially on public Wi-Fi. Get IPVanish now for 70% off a yearly plan with this exclusive offer at ipvanish.com/audio.
Shh, be very, very quiet.
Secret? What secret?
Our dirty little secret.
I tell you something I've never told anyone.
Yeah, I went through a lot of choices with this. I'm going to give you some of the almosts, just because, you know, kind of how my brain went. I talked about Taken, you know, there's some feel there. I talked about Hitchcock, certainly thought about North by Northwest. The Man Who Knew Too Much feels very much like this. Those would have been easy choices. I even thought about, like, what is a movie where somebody, you know, somebody's loved one gets taken away from them, and the rest of the movie is them just trying to, you know, fight through things. And I thought a Pig, you know, with Nicolas Cage gets the pig taken from him, you know, those kind of things. But eventually, the one that felt the most tonally consistent with me in the best double feature would be Dead Calm.
Ooh, such a good movie.
I really, really dig this movie, and I like mentioning it as a double feature, even just to bring some attention to it. It's Nicole Kidman, Sam Elliott, I believe, and has a very similar premise in that it is a couple who's taken advantage of and split up. However, it highlights the woman's role in this in a much more prominent way. And in fact, it turns it on its head in many ways. And Nicole Kidman is fabulous in this movie. Yeah, I think Dead Calm would be a great double feature, with Breakdown. That's my choice.
I sometimes wonder if our chat is like 3 seconds, 5 seconds behind or whatever, because it's like, come on, Dicer, Sam Neill. You said Sam Neill, did you not?
I think so. I thought I did.
I don't know. That's,
they are, and by the way, the live chat is about 2 to 3 minutes behind.
Okay. So sometimes wonder about that. I'm like sitting there like, come on, chat. Billy Zane is the other person in this movie, by the way.
Yeah.
That movie is great. Dead Calm is a perfect choice. And in fact, I almost want to big recommend it soon because it's so good.
We can do that.
Because not very many people have seen that, I don't feel like. So.
Apparently, I said Sam Elliott. If that's the case, then I totally get the Sam Neill correction.
Oh, said Sam Elliott. See, once again, I totally did not hear you say that. I'm sitting there thinking Sam Neill. I hear Sam something, and I'm like, that's it. That's the name.
Sam Elliott, Jessica Lansbury, starring in a movie together.
Oh, fucking Sam Elliott, man! I had no idea you had said that. I was like, yeah, Sam Elliott. Yeah, that makes sense. Oh, yeah, Sam Elliott is who it is.
He's interesting movie.
Beautiful New Zealand twang to Sam Elliott. All right, Aaron, it is your turn for next week. So what are you going to recommend for us next week?
Too much Hitchcock talk today to not do a Hitchcock movie. We are going to do Notorious for the big recommend.
Yes. This is a good one.
One of my favorite Hitches, and one of the underseen, I believe. Let's get some Cary Grant in our lives. Let's get some Hitchcock in our lives. Let's watch Notorious together.
Yeah, man, I'm all about this. I haven't seen it in quite some time, but yeah, this is a good one, and so I can't wait to revisit it. All right, we have some time for some questions, and holy hell, we may just run out of questions. Who knows? We'll see.
Question.
I got something to say.
I want the truth.
I am listening.
What is the weirdest pet you have ever owned?
Well, the good news, Chris, is that I think I'll have a weird enough pet that counts for both of us. Like, it'll be so weird that it'll count for both. I actually had a bluegill fish as a pet when I was growing up, and that was because my dad was a fisherman. He had a pond he'd go to, and it was basically stocked with bluegill and walleye. And that was basically it. That was the fishing in this little town of Ohio that I grew up in. And he caught this little bluegill. Wasn't really worth cooking up anything like that. And so we put it in. We had a lamp, like a lamp fixture. That was an old glass, like a jug band has the jug that you blow on kind of thing. It was like that, but it was glass and big and had like a hole cut out of it. And so we put water in that and then put the bluegill in there. And then it was in our living room. It was a light that had a bluegill swimming around in it. And we would feed it worms and whatever else, crickets and whatever we could find. And it lived for at least a month or two. So, you know.
Man, that's the thing. Fish are just so hard to keep. I mean, unless you're just like on it, I guess. I don't know. I remember having fish as a kid, and it seemed like we always, I mean, it was just, you either just didn't clean the tank enough or you didn't feed them enough or whatever. And they just, and it's just sad. They die so quickly. And I used to love getting those betta fish, man. But betta fish are like, you know, they're very aggressive. And, you know, after a while, you'll say, oh, what a beautiful betta fish. And then the next day you'll see like one of the fish is dead and the betta fish has got stuff ripped off of it as well because it got into a fight or something. I will go ahead and talk about Jeremy's on here because I've never owned a weird pet, I don't believe. It's always been cats. So Jeremy said he had guinea pigs for a while after they were class pets, and he goes, do not, is what he wrote on there. I guess he means don't get guinea pigs, I guess. I mean, I guess that I knew someone had a guinea pig once. So, I mean, they're kind of fun. They make that noise when you come down the stairs or whatever. They're ready to get fed, that little whistling, whipping sound or whatever.
I had friends that had snakes as pets.
Oh yeah.
And there's something, I'm trying not to be judgmental, but there's something about keeping predators as pets that's interesting to me, and the idea of like buying live mice to feed to your pet, like there's something about it that's that I find fascinating on the human psychology level of like keeping a predator in your home in that way. So, but then again, you know, dogs come from wolves, I guess. I don't know. Mm-hmm. So,
yeah, that's true.
I just don't buy live rabbits to feed my dogs. So,
yeah. Over in the chat, let's see, we have Josh says, I had a pet crawdad once. I wonder how that worked, by the way. Tatsu talks about the betta fish against my will. I learned that they kill other fish viciously. Yes, they do. That's the thing about them. Link says, I had a gecko for a little bit. Shaggy says, tried to have a spider. Craster says, I had guinea pigs back in grade school. They were adorable. Yes, they are indeed adorable. Nick says, my wife had a betta fish in college named Fishy, and it lived for a few years. Well, way to go. Way to go there. I can never get that long. Josh says, I used to keep gerbils, but them them dudes stink after a while. peeing everywhere in their cage. So there you go. That's a question I couldn't answer, but apparently everybody's tried to do stuff like crawdads and spiders, and I never tried that. All right, the next one. When you were a kid, what movie did you act out, pretend the most?
I mean, the answer is Star Wars. If we're doing an actual, like, count the hours you pretended to be in this movie, it's Star Wars. The amount of lightsaber, fake lightsaber fights I had with friends growing up, I was perfect in that age. I think the original came out basically the year after I was born. So my entire childhood was New Hope, Empire Strikes Back, Return of the Jedi on VHS, playing it over and over, taped from TV. And just doing that stuff. So that's got to be the actual answer. If I wanted to pick an answer that feels more like what I set out to do, it might be Narnia. It might be like the Narnia movies. At that point, they were TV movies. I wasn't young when the newer Narnia movies came out, but I would pretend like, you know, the big snow fort was a transportation into Narnia, and then we'd be in Narnia and that kind of stuff growing up. So, I think that was the most fun I have ever pretended to be in, like a movie world, book world slash thing. But the Star Wars is just the easy answer.
I'll read Jeremy's on this one as well. He said, not a movie, but a show, Lost in Space. My brother and I used to have regular arguments about who would be Don and who would be John. So that's funny. I don't think I watched all of Lost in Space, but I definitely watched the show back in the day. Mine is Back to the Future. It's as simple as the fact that I got the VHS copy of Back to the Future. I think it was in 1987 or something like that. And I watched it, I think, 2 weeks straight. Never one day did I miss watching Back to the Future. And I knew that movie back and forth. So, like, I would just go into different things all the time with that movie, just different scenes. And so, especially the one where Biff and Leah Thompson are in the car. And no, I didn't do that. That's the movie that I probably acted out the most, especially all the little action scenes that were going on in it. Going to the chat, Josh and Slab both said Ghostbusters. Link and Slab both say Star Wars. Link also says, I bet Ian would have said Star Trek. I don't know. Maybe he would have.
Doctor Who might be.
Ian like Star Trek? Nick says it's definitely Star Wars, but also Back to the Future. But mostly we did TV shows like X-Men, Power Rangers, or Batman. Shaggy says TMNT. Castro says probably The Matrix, which is weird because I didn't watch it until like 3 years ago. Nice. So let's see what else. Oh, and Tatsu says Street Fighter 2, the animated movie, the fight scenes and moves. I still want to catch an attacker with a shuriken, honestly. Okay, we got some room for one more, I think. Who is your favorite movie horse?
Such an interesting question.
Yes, it is.
I mean, just for sheer emotional attachment alone, I went with Artax from The NeverEnding Story. And the amount of pain. Oh no, you went with that. Sorry, that was.
Yeah, that's not your answer.
No, my answer is Maximus from Tangled. Is what I have written down. Really fun horse, and the chemistry between him and Zach Levy's character in that is really fun. So yeah, mm-hmm. Went with Maximus. Yep. But also your answer is better, so I stole it.
Yes, mine is Artax. That horse, I don't know. You don't really. I'm trying to think if there's any part of that movie where you're like, oh, I love that horse, until he gets into the swamps of sadness and like he can't get out of the swamp, and that scene is just, oh, it's so devastating. You're just like, oh my god, why is a horse succumbing to sadness? Why is Atreyu not succumbing to the sadness watching his horse go into the swamps of sadness? I don't know, but I feel so bad. And luckily they had the little Deus Ex Machina at the end that got everything back.
Mm-hmm.
You know, everybody's living again. It's all in your imagination anyway. You don't have to worry about that.
Mm-hmm.
And then I'll also mention Jeremy's. Jeremy says the one that John Wick gets to back kick the bad guys in John Wick 3. That is a great horse for sure. Going over to the chat, we have, Link says Maximus, Nick says Shadowfax. That's a great horse, obviously. Mm-hmm.
Sure.
Shaggy says the horse from Hot to Trot. I don't think I've ever seen Hot to Trot. James says the Black Stallion. If I said the horse from War Horse, CinemaSins might hunt me down. Yeah, you know what though? I think you can like that horse. You're just not allowed to like the movie at all. The movie is awful. Yeah, exactly. Tatsu says favorite horse, the Mulan horse. That is going to do it for this week. Guys, thank you for coming out and watching us once again. Next week is Notorious, Alfred Hitchcock's masterpiece. Can't wait to talk about that again. That's going to do it for this week. So we'll see you next time.
See you guys.
See ya. Bye. part of the live show by being a member of the Sin Club at Patreon at patreon.com/cinemasins. Chat with us on the CinemaSins Discord at discord.gg/cinemasins or CinemaSins Twitter at CinemaSins, and email any comments or questions to recotopia@cinemasins.com. That's recotopia@cinemasins.com. All right, so you either got a haircut or you're slicking the hair back.
This is got a late start on the day and got my run in and finished about 25 minutes ago. So this is immediately out of the shower hair. So at some point between our pre-show conversation and the main show, I will fluff it a little bit and let it, you know, kind of bounce out, but no haircut. Aha. just immediately slicked back after the shower look.
I see. So, all right.
Yeah. Aren't you glad you asked? You know,
now I am very happy that I asked. Yes.
It's been interesting. You know, it's been like 18 months since I've been growing it out. Mm-hmm. And like, there are stages, like this is what my hair person tells me. In order for it, you know, you don't just like grow it for 18 months and then trim it. You kind of go through stages. So she's at this stage now where she wants to let the sides grow more. So it comes more down in and out. And so every single time I think I have a handle on what my hair is going to look like, she's like, now we're doing this. And I'm like, all right, I'll just look different, you know, every month of my life from here until I die.
Yeah, it's like it's like a downtown section that's always got scaffolding and bulldozers around it, and you're like, is there ever going to be a time where I can go to the city and not worry about like construction and stuff like that? Can experience the city without that once?
That is so true. We have an expressway into town that is always adding a lane. Like when we moved here, there were two lanes. I think they're up to five now, and it's like one lane a year. It's like, just, you know, make it an 8-lane highway and just be done with it.
I'm pretty sure I'm not talking out of my ass here, that more lanes doesn't necessarily mean everybody just starts to get to move faster now.
Yeah.
It just means that slow cars will continue to go into other lanes and your fast cars will continue to weave in and out like they always did. And it doesn't really do anything.
My wife and I were just talking a couple days ago. There are three spots in our world of driving that have recently been constructed in a way that is confusing people. Now, this isn't typical Midwestern town finally starts doing roundabouts and nobody knows how to use the roundabout confusion. That's happening here as well. But that's not what this is. This is left turn lanes that are now straight through lanes. So people who have been living their life using a certain lane to turn left on this road, now when they're in this lane, have to go straight. And so there are like three instances of these where they're probably right construction-wise. It's better to have it this way. But so many people are used to it the other way that there's just people like, I'm in the wrong lane, and they're darting in and out of lanes and that kind of stuff. One of them is on the expressway. It's now like a 2-lane exit instead of a 1-lane exit. And they don't have the, you know, this lane must exit sign up yet over the highway. And so there's all these people just darting left back into the expressway because they don't realize they're in there. Yeah.
There's some things that I don't know what they're thinking at all. There's a place in Nashville that they changed, I don't know, a year or two ago. You have lanes that are on this one road that you can go straight or you can turn right on the interstate. And the interstate's never had like a proper like lane to get in. It's got one, but it's like, it's a car or two that can fit into it. And most of the time people just get over before the lane is even available to them because it's ridiculous. You would have to stay behind all this long line of cars just to get to that. But they did something recently where they changed all this stuff up and they gave the other side, the oncoming traffic lane, the left turn lane, the right of way if you are going onto the interstate. So like if you're turning right, which in every place in the entire United States, if you're turning right, you've got the right of way usually in that situation,
right.
Unless the car is already halfway through and you know, you just got there. It's, and in this one, you could get into the right lane conceivably, and the guy in the left turn lane on the other side decides, I got to go now. And you have to stop where you normally never had to stop. You never have to stop when you're turning right, unless there's, you know, cars that are already coming. Mm-hmm. So it just, what was the idea behind that? What were they? I mean, and people who were turning left, they also, even though they have that right of way, it's so unusual that you see people kind of hesitate, like, I don't know if I should do this. So yeah. Why did they even bother?
I don't know. It's wild. I found myself in one of those, I don't know if you've ever seen one, but like a YouTube channel that's dedicated to like fix this intersection YouTube. Mm-hmm. So like people will send them terrible intersections and then they will pull it up on Google Maps and like move stuff around. And so like, this is how they should, you know, construct it. I always find that stuff really, really interesting. They did something similar with if you're coming towards the road to turn left onto the road, you now have to go past the road to a stoplight that has literally not a left turn arrow. It has a U-turn arrow. So the stoplight literally has a green light for U-turn to turn around and go down
that
road.
That's crazy.
Yeah. So it's an interesting, and it kind of works. I actually kind of love it. It's you know, and the reason being is that there were two roads that are fairly well used that are just offset on that road. And so the stoplight is at the further one. And so it's basically a left turn onto that road. You just have to U-turn and go back to it.
Yeah,
so.
Yeah. I can say if you've got a dedicated U-turn light where you can safely do it and not worry about other traffic, then I see no problem with that, especially if it fixes things.
Yeah. Yeah, it seemed to. So I always find that really like infrastructure stuff interesting, like people putting their brains on that stuff. It's fascinating to me.
I do have a friend who texts me about movies all the time. And the thing, I think I may have railed about this before, but whatever, I'll rail about it again. He keeps sending me news about movies that are at the Venice Film Festival or the Cannes Film Festival or any of these. And it's always like, this movie got a 15-minute standing ovation. And for the longest time, I thought that was complete bullshit. I just thought that writers were just kind of, that was long. That was 15 minutes. And they didn't time it or anything like that.
Mm-hmm.
Until someone sent me a video of, I think it was a Quentin Tarantino movie. It may have been Inglourious Basterds or something. Or maybe Once Upon a Time in Hollywood. It shows the standing ovation, and yeah, it lasts for whatever long they said in the news, 12 to 13. And there's a latest Pedro Almodovar movie got an 18-minute standing ovation. So if I'm ever in a situation where I'm at a film festival and the standing ovation goes beyond 1 minute, I'm probably going to be gone. I'm sorry. I think I've paid my respects after the 1 minute. I don't need to do the 18 minute standing ovation. It's not like Pedro Almodovar is going to come up to me and say, oh my God, thank you for being a part of that. That was amazing. You know, I don't understand it. I don't get it. Why does an ovation last that long?
Yeah. Yeah. Meanwhile, the guy doing the heart transplant, nobody's applauding, you know?
No. Nope. And I guess other movie news would be that, so I was at a Red Cross, and I occasionally give blood and platelets and stuff like that.
Mm-hmm.
And when you give platelets, it takes forever. It's like a 2-hour process when they do that. So they set you up with screens, and you can watch like Netflix and stuff like that. And I watched a movie I'd never seen before, The Circle, the Emma Watson, Tom Hanks.
Oh yeah, yeah, yeah.
Movie. I'm gonna preface this by saying I enjoyed watching the movie. However, it's one of those things where it's like, here's an idea, we're not gonna explore that idea, But here's the idea, and it keeps you kind of like wrapped up a little bit, but it's just everything is underdeveloped in that movie. It was so weird to watch, because I was like, I kind of want to know what happens, but at the same time, nothing is like Emma Watson goes from like, I don't know, she's very excited to be at this company. And then she's just willing to do a whole bunch of stuff out of nowhere, it feels like, where it doesn't seem part of her character to do these type of things. And then, you know, this is one of those companies that's just like, they're so evil that they don't even blink when it comes to like doing stuff that the world would be like, no, we're not going to be part of this. But because they're such a big company, everything they introduce is like, yeah, let's ruin everybody's privacy. Not a big deal. No, nobody cares. And I mean, I guess in a way we kind of live that world in a little bit, but the lines they cross in this are just, they're just openly saying this is what we're doing. And it just, I didn't know where I was trying to find out what the point of that movie was. Mm-hmm. I mean, it wasn't subtle enough to be like, oh, that's just evil. It's just, they were just out openly evil the whole time. So it right. was just like, yeah, I mean, nobody would go for this if you presented it this way, but if you did it in a more underhanded manner, I'd be going more along the ride this movie's trying to take me. Do you remember The Circle? Did you watch it?
I do. I remember after The Circle feeling even more like technology. Like, because the idea are these tiny cameras that go everywhere. And so like it's a complete omniscience of information kind of idea, right? And I remember thinking this is likely a possible technology of the future. Like I don't think it's way out of hand to think that, you know, you could have cameras already are that small. The idea that they could be immediately wirelessly connected, you know, whatever is different, and battery and power and those kind of things are, you know, will come along. And I just remember thinking even more so than ever that privacy is probably an element of the past, that like our kids will just exist in a world where everybody knows everything about everybody because it's all public. And that sounds crazy to us. And, but technology is just too good. And then power becomes about who has the oversight of that information. And,
Does it get to the point where they're like, well, you have to register for us so that you can vote and stuff like that?
Yeah.
That's just easy to go out there and do. But anyway, that movie is fascinating on many levels, but it's also like not a great movie by
any
means.
No, it's not.
It's just kind of fun.